It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the approaching debt ceiling standoff. But first, it used to be a handful of big-name board games cornered the market. War horses like Monopoly, Trivial Pursuit, and Scrabble.
Our Geek Out contributor, Patrick Rothfuss, says we're in the midst of a board game renaissance, and he's here to tell us more and share some of his favorites. Patrick is the best-selling fantasy author of The Name of the Wind, and he's from Wisconsin. Pat, welcome to Central Time.
Hey there, guys.
So why do you say we're in the midst of a board game renaissance?
Well, you're absolutely right. There used to be kind of these big monolithic games that everybody knew about. You'd play Monopoly or Trivial Pursuit or Scrabble, and they've been around kind of forever, and everyone knew about it, and everybody had a copy in their cupboard. And then if you went a little further afield, you'd get like Sorry or Trouble or Yahtzee. And then it kind of petered out, unless you were doing like a really weird, specialized niche game, like you were doing submarine combat, and these games would, you know, take 2 hours to set up and 4 hours to play, and they were really intense and really only appealed to a very certain specific kind of person. But in these last 10 years, it's really taken off, and the field has opened up, because now people can kind of create games much more easily and market them on the internet, and that allows a lot of, you know, the board game equivalent of like startup businesses. People can create their own studios, fund their own games on Kickstarter, and then suddenly you have this explosion of new ideas on the scene.
So we've got these tween games. They're not the old standbys. They're not the super specialized niche ones. What do these games bring to the table that the other ones didn't?
You know, a lot of it, one of the big things is that these games are better games. The reason that a lot of people play Monopoly is because you know Monopoly and you own a copy and, you know, everyone kind of knows the rules. But, I mean, have you ever, like, really enjoyed
no.
a game?
It's a bad game.
Monopoly?
Sorry.
I have.
Yeah.
Does that make me a bad person?
Yes.
Okay.
No. What it is usually what you're really enjoying is spending time with your family, you know, or with your friends. And sometimes the game itself, it's okay, but there's very little skill involved in a game of Monopoly. You know, you roll the dice, do you buy the property or not? And then that continues for, like, 45 minutes. And the only choice you're making is, do I buy a property or not? And that's not a really dynamic interaction. You're not really solving any problems there. But these days, there are some games you can learn how to play in half an hour, and you can play it with a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, and it's fun, and they're interactive, and you can beat people, and you can win your first time out of the gate playing this game, and it can be fun for the whole family. And then you can play it again that same night, and nobody has to flip the table over because you just spent 2 hours trying to get that last property, and nobody can build any hotels, you know?
Well, do you think that the richness you're talking about is because there are more elements now of fantasy and role-playing and creating these worlds? I'm thinking about new games. Well, I guess they're not even that new anymore, but something like Settlers of Catan, for instance, where you're sort of starting a civilization with sheep and stuff.
That's exactly it. And Settlers of Catan really, like, it blew the lid off the whole thing, where suddenly here's a game that I remember, you know, and this was probably 10, 15 years ago, I remember finding out that our neighbors up the hill played it, and their daughter, who was 10 years old, was a diva, and, like, regularly beat her parents at this game. And, like, and you have to be smart, and you have to plan ahead and manage your resources to be good at Catan. And she was. She was good at that. I mean, I think, you know, and besides, you know, what do you really have to manage in Monopoly? It's they're not comparable games at all. Plus, a game of Catan you can play in, like, an hour and then do it again.
Let's name some more names, Patrick. What are some of your other favorites apart from Settlers?
Well, you have to be aware when you kind of set foot into this world, there's different kinds of games. There's like a 45-minute game, which is nice. Or then there's like an hour-and-a-half game, which is also nice, but it's a different sort of experience. For like a lighter, more fun, easy-to-learn, casual game, Settlers is wonderful. I'm very fond lately of a game called King of Tokyo. It's very new, and everyone here and all of my friends and everyone I work with, we play this game like crazy, and you can play it in like 20 minutes.
What is it? What do you do?
You all play like giant monsters destroying Tokyo, like a Godzilla movie. You know, and you roll some dice, and you punch each other, and then somebody wins, and you laugh, and then you play it again.
The shortness factor I can see would be appealing when everyone's crunched for time, if you can get through it quickly.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, you know, if you play a game of Monopoly, you know, somebody wins and feels very smug, and everybody else is a little disgruntled. But if you play a shorter game, you can play two or three times, and everyone gets a new chance to win.
So as a geek who played those specialty games you're talking about, it was always difficult to introduce them to the normals. And it was clear to them that they were crossing a threshold of geekery. These new games you're talking about, these Euro games, I think they call them, is it a friendly way for us geeks and the normals to meet halfway?
Oh, absolutely. I honestly think of them as a gateway drug. Because, truthfully, we all enjoy playing games. And when you talk about these specialty games, like what did you used to play?
Do you have an hour? No, games like Magic Realm, Republic of Rome, these things could take hours to set up sometimes and then hours to play. And yeah, it was a different sort of scene that a lot of people weren't into, with good reason.
And the classic example is Civilization, a game which quite literally would take 10 hours to play. a game that very few people ever finished playing. And like, who wants that to be their first game experience after Monopoly? That's not going to win anyone over. But you know, some of these gateway drugs, King of Tokyo is fun, and you can learn it literally in 5 minutes, and then go out and play some more. And it's just like popcorn.
Do you think that we still need to honor these old games? I mean, obviously not a fan of Monopoly on your part, but what about, you know, Scrabble and Trivial Pursuit? Or is it just, you know, kind of like video games where you go back, like I did recently and played Galaga, and I kind of lost interest after my, you know, fourth or fifth game, because the new games are just so much better.
The new games really are so much better. It's sort of like, you know, sometimes it's like you go back and you watch a classic movie. I just watched The Wizard of Oz, and I thought, this is a classic movie for a reason. Everyone watches this for a reason. But sometimes you go back and watch a movie that you loved as a child, and you realize that the only reason you loved it is maybe because you didn't have a lot of critical faculties. You know, Candyland does not hold up over time. It's great for teaching kids how to play a game, but eventually, I mean, there's games that will teach kids how to play games that don't make you as a parent or an aunt or an uncle really want to gnaw your arm. You know, and that's unfortunate. Like my little boy loves to play Candyland, but you know, you really get the urge to stack the deck after a while.
There's no just so it ends. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Pat, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
One thing that I do want to throw out really quickly. There's a show called Tabletop. It's available on YouTube. Will Wheaton, Geek's celebrity, runs it, and he shows people new games and how to play them. It's a smorgasbord. He brings in witty, fantastic people, and you get to watch them play these games. So that can be like your sampler platter. You can go and see what might suit you and what might look fun to play.
All right. That was Patrick Rothfuss. He's a best-selling fantasy author of The Name of the Wind.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Mary Lou Williams is a jazz pianist, composer, and band leader. Our next guest says she should be a household name, but she isn't.
Wisconsin poet Fabu wrote a book of poetry about Mary Lou Williams called Remember Me, and she's doing a multimedia performance at Madison's Overture Center this Friday. Rob talked to her yesterday morning.
Fabu, thanks so much for joining us today.
I am really excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, what captured your attention about Mary Lou Williams?
Well, it's just that I grew up in jazz, and I know something about loving jazz and listening to jazz and maybe even jazz history, but I never knew about Mary Lou Williams. And for me as an adult woman, that was kind of shocking. And so to read her biographies and then to take a year-long celebration, be part of that. And then finally, to research her myself, that has been the best part of my journey to find out about Mary Lou Williams.
Well, just the little bit I've looked at her, and I hadn't heard about her either. She did so much. Can you talk about her career as an instrumentalist, a composer, and so many other things?
She was an incredible jazz genius, and that really is saying it mildly, because she played every kind of jazz from, say, 1920 to 1980. And she did that because she was a child prodigy, and she started off with early jazz like stride, went through boogie, bebop, free jazz. So she was always experimenting, exploring, and she really stands among the greats of jazz.
Let's give a little listen now. This one is, I think, Nightlife, just her on the piano. So, since you started this project, how does it feel to listen to her play?
It's a deeper experience. I enjoyed her music from the beginning. I always liked it. But now that I've done the research and know, for example, a piece you just played, Nightlife, she was actually just messing around in a recording studio before they were even going to tape. She didn't realize she was being taped when they recorded that selection, Nightlife. And it appeared on a record. So it's knowing the really interesting tidbits like that that make listening to her a much richer experience.
Well, a big part of your performance this weekend is the poetry, and I'd like to hear a couple of the poems. You can pick one. I see you brought a few to read for us today.
Thank you, because, you know, that's the major part of the program, me translating the music and the life of Mary Lou Williams into words. Mm-hmm. This poem is called The Artist, Mary Lou Williams. She was artist first, a toddler musical prodigy, can't really explain herself by gender or color. Her I'm artist first sensibility defined her career, not her sex or race. Men jazzers couldn't intimidate her strong right hand and her rockin' left domination. She grew up in jazz, was raised by jazz, loved and comforted others through jazz, and was forever excited by jazz, 'cause she liked to keep experimenting. Mary Lou Williams never believed she was less for being midnight black or curvy short. She was the song, the lady who swings the band. She earned her title, Mary, Queen of Jazz.
Men jazzers couldn't intimidate, was one of the lines. How hard was it for her as a woman, instrumentalist, composer, band leader, in what a lot of people think of as a men's world of jazz, especially in her early days?
Well, here's the unique thing about Mary Lou. She entered jazz when she was a child. Mm-hmm. So part of her experience was that she was looked after and cared for. But she never learned to be intimidated or afraid of men. And it was a wonderful interview with the late Miriam McPartland when she said, you just got to play. You got to play strong, and you got to just show them that you're as good a musician as them. And so for her, she just looked at the whole area of jazz as very unique, like, of course I can do this, and yes, I do. In fact, she taught Thelonious Monk, and she helped Bud Powell, and she listened to John Coltrane and gave them advice. So she very clearly dominated the field of jazz as a musician, because, for example, most people know women in jazz as singers, mm-hmm. but not as those who compose and who arrange.
Well, I'm just blown away. Why isn't she a household name like Thelonious Monk, like John Coltrane?
I actually explore that in my poetry, and I have a poem that I'm going to read the night of the event at the Overture Center, which asks the question, why were you forgotten, Mary Lou? In her heyday, she was on radio. She had a radio program. She was on television. She traveled internationally. She was contemporary with Duke Ellington. She arranged for Benny Goodman. So there was actually no area of jazz that she didn't touch.
Yeah.
So that becomes the quixotic question for me. How is it that this woman can be so strong for so long, and actually to the very time of her death, she had a piano moved into her hospital room in North Carolina, and she played.
Never wanted to stop.
A piano was always a good friend to her, a loyal friend. And I believe it was her way of speaking to others in the world. For example, she said, "When I play, I pray. I want my music to heal you." She saw jazz as healing in whatever form that it was played in.
Well, let's hear another one of the selections you brought from your poetry.
This one is called My Place of Warming Prayer, and it connects to the fact that she really saw her jazz as being something that was healing to people as they listened. "Now the fog shifts with the start of sunlight. I smell the sweetness of morning coming, see the bright colors of dawn shifting, shadows and shapes into clear, widening pools of fresh water which satisfy my desperate thirst from the long, dry night on my knees." So Mary Lou left the stage in Paris, France, and didn't do jazz for about 3 years. And it was because of all the fights she had over royalties, all the fights she had over people taking her music. And in jazz, they didn't mind if you borrowed pieces, but of course everyone minded if you didn't say, "That's a Mary Lou piece that I borrowed." And so in Paris, France, she had a kind of a crisis, and she left the stage, centered herself into prayer, and came back stronger than ever.
And a lot of her music, going through the titles, it's sacred jazz in some cases, or religious or Christian themed. Am I right about that? I'm just going by titles here.
Yeah, but that's the extraordinary thing. She was the first jazz artist. I mean, she pushed jazz to every limit that it could possibly go, and then beyond any boundaries that people knew of, because she actually created what she calls sacred jazz. And for her, it was just an extension of her continuing to explore and experiment and to be herself in all of her music. And she created what came to be called Mary's Mass. And the thing about her sacred music, it was on the same exceptional level as every other kind of jazz that she played. So it was as wonderful as her boogies. It was as wonderful as any of her other pieces. And that makes her remarkable.
Let's hear another selection. I see you brought three, it looks like.
"Remember Me, Mary Lou Williams."
And this is the title of your book.
This is the title of the book. And I found out from someone who actually saw her performance that this is what she would say often in the midst of performance. She'd be pounding a fast boogie or maybe feathering a soft piece of free jazz, sitting on a smooth piano bench in the latest lace fashion, her glamorous dress designed for her hands to flow over keys and her feet to beat pedals. She turned her face to one side, look out over the audience with a shy smile. She'd command, "I am Mary Lou Williams. Remember me. Remember I lived to play jazz. Remember I traveled the world giving away jazz. Remember that I suffered and cried when others stole my arrangements, compositions. Remember I loved jazz and jazz loved me back. I am Mary Lou Williams. Remember me."
Let's give another listen to a track and picture her turning her face to one side with that shy smile. And there's some of that boogie you mentioned earlier.
Yes, she's just extraordinary for that. That's a beautiful, fast piece.
Now, talk us through. We only have another minute or so left. What will we see at your performance Saturday?
Well, it's a multimedia presentation, so the poetry will be there. But also we have two local actresses, Trinity Middlebrook and Theola Carter, who are going to play the child Mary Lou and the adult Mary Lou. We'll have Mary Lou's compositions played by pianist Jane Reynolds and bassist Nick Moran. So there'll also be some videotape of Mary Lou so you can see the actual woman and her playing. So it's a really, to me, artistic expression to try and capture the depth of this woman, Mary Lou Williams.
All right, Fabu, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
That was Fabu, former poet laureate of Madison and author of Remember Me, Jazz Genius Mary Lou Williams in Poetry. She performs this Friday evening at 7 o'clock at Madison's Overture Center.
Coming up, a look at the economic impact of the debt ceiling crisis. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin is the number one producer of frac sand in the country. There are now more than 100 facilities across the state.
In part two of our WPR series examining the industry's effect on public health, Rich Kramer looks into the chemicals used to process frac sand and whether they're polluting groundwater.
Before a frac sand mine is approved, there are public hearings, and at nearly every one of these meetings, concerned citizens argue that the chemicals used to wash frac sand are toxic and could get into groundwater in private wells. The chemical people are most concerned about is called polyacrylamide, which is used to get mud and silt out of the water used to wash the sand. UW-Eau Claire geology professor Kent Severson says polyacrylamide itself is harmless, but it's made from a toxic chemical called acrylamide.
And there will always be kind of trace amounts or residual amounts of acrylamide that are present in that polyacrylamide as well.
Is it possible for this acrylamide to get into the groundwater?
Certainly. It could get into the groundwater, and that's why this is an issue that is out there. And then if the acrylamide is in the water, then the question would be how much of it is in there, what concentration is in the water, what direction is moving, how fast it's moving, and how far before it might encounter a private well.
While Severson says it's possible, there haven't been any studies to prove this happens. Even so, the Department of Natural Resources has regulations aimed at keeping too much of these chemicals from getting into the groundwater. DNR wastewater specialist Roberta Walls says permits limit how much polyacrylamide sand mines can use and requires them to keep records to show they're within the law.
We would be able to backtrack on that and determine whether or not they're staying within their use restriction.
But the DNR doesn't do any follow-up testing of water at the mine to make sure companies are following the polyacrylamide limits. Walls says she's even run into frac sand mines that don't follow the law at all.
I have encountered facilities that have not kept the appropriate records.
Whether or not the mines follow the law, it's unclear whether toxic acrylamide makes its way into nearby wells. But there is one ongoing study working to answer that question. It's not being done by the EPA or state DNR. Instead, it's led by the Chippewa County Land Conservation Department, tucked away in the basement of the county courthouse. Seth Abel is their process engineer.
When the companies do want to use polyacrylamide, we have a process set up which says you need to keep track of how much flocculant you're using. We want that reported at the end of the year in an annual report. And then any waste materials generated at the site, that we do a test for acrylamide. And then also that we do any testing of any, basically any settling ponds. We install a monitoring well and do groundwater testing. Down gradient of that.
Abel says after 2 years of testing, they haven't found any acrylamide in the groundwater or the leftover mud. He says that's not the final word, but they feel very good about the results. And that's good news for frac sand miners in Chippewa County. Brian Wurzel is the superintendent for Superior Silica Sands Wash Plant in New Auburn. He says they've been working with the county to prove their process and the chemicals they use are safe.
You know, it has been tested, and that's why we do our well sampling. You know, we haven't had any hits on the acrylamide in our groundwater to date, and we've been here 2.5 years.
While Chippewa County's efforts are a start, most everybody involved, from regulators to concerned citizens, agree that more study is needed to find out exactly how this chemical breaks down and how it moves through the groundwater. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Rich Kramer for that report. It's day 8 of the government shutdown, and pundits and politicians are starting to look ahead to the next big fiscal battle, the debt ceiling.
Treasury Secretary Jack Lew says the United States is going to run out of borrowed money on October 17th. Well, from time to time, we call up Chris Farrell, economics editor for Marketplace Money, to help us figure out what these things mean for us and for the economy. Chris, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'll try.
You'll try. So what, give us the debt ceiling 101. What happens on October 17th-ish?
Well, what happens at that point is the government, unless it can borrow more money, isn't going to be able to pay some of its bills, right? Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, there's a lot of uncertainty about that statement because, well, it could prioritize, with the jargon term that's out there is prioritize. It could go ahead and pay Social Security. It could pay Medicare bills. It would pay its veterans bills, but it not pay, may not pay some other bills. So technically, they could maybe avoid default by making some payments are priority and other payments not, so they keep making those interest payments. But here's the thing. You don't want to get to that world. There's nothing good to be said that if the Treasury faces that risk of default, that somehow it can avoid it and that's a good thing. No, the Treasury shouldn't even come close to dealing with the risk of default.
Well, the tricky thing about talking about what would happen in a case of default is a lack of precedent. We have not seen anything like this happening in recent American history.
No, that's right. And but this is there's a couple reasons why, you know, I'm in the camp, or I believe, and I think most people are in this camp, frankly, this is a disaster. You know, if you think about every pension fund in the United States, it's built on a foundation of U.S. Treasuries. Wall Street is built on a foundation of U.S. Treasuries. Every finance textbook, mutual fund pamphlet, personal finance book describes U.S. Treasuries as your riskless security, right? We all know stocks are volatile, right? And companies can go bankrupt, and corporations can go bankrupt, and their debt can go bad. But you build your foundation for your long-term savings on this riskless security called U.S. Treasuries. And once you default, it's no longer a riskless security. And that's what has everyone really scared. This riskless security is what the financial system is built upon.
Well, President Obama spoke earlier today. We aired that here on the Ideas Network. Let's give a listen to him talking a little bit about the consequences of not raising that debt ceiling.
Now, the last time that the Tea Party Republicans flirted with the idea of default 2 years ago, markets plunged, business and consumer confidence plunged, America's credit rating was downgraded for the first time, and a decision to actually go through with it, to actually permit default, according to many CEOs and economists, would be, and I'm quoting here, insane, catastrophic, chaos. These are some of the more polite words. Warren Buffett likened default to a nuclear bomb, a weapon too horrible to use. It would disrupt markets. It would undermine the world's confidence in America as the bedrock of the global economy. And it might permanently increase our borrowing costs.
All right, let's unpack some of that, Chris. So first of all, we're at the point where we were earlier, where we're near the cliff. Are we seeing issues with consumer confidence that President Obama was talking about in the previous near miss?
I think we are seeing modest signs of consumer confidence. The previous near miss was in the so that was the summer of 2011, August of 2011. And we were at that period of time, if you remember, where the economy was growing, and we've been growing at this 2% average annual rate. And it appeared like the economy was gathering some momentum. And then you had the debt limit crisis and the near default. And that definitely had an impact in terms of, you know, hesitation on hiring, hesitation on capital equipment expansions, and an impact on consumer confidence and on Wall Street confidence. So we continued to expand at this 2% rate, but we didn't get up to that higher rate of growth that we really want. Now we're here. And the one difference between 2011 and now is that the threat of default is being taken more seriously. When I would call mainstream economists, you know, at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, or University of Minnesota, you know, and I'd say, this is back in 2011, I said, you know, they're threatening default. Chris, why are you even reporting on this? Why are you even talking about this? This is just histrionics. We got so close. Now you call these exact same people up, and you say, what about the risk of default? And there's this long pause. Then there's a deep sigh. We haven't got any words out yet. And then they say, well, I hope it doesn't happen. It would be, just as Obama's saying, catastrophic, whatever term that they want to use. So we're taking it more seriously. And so part of the damage that's happening right now is who isn't being hired because of the uncertainty? What capital project isn't being funded because of the uncertainty? And I think it's weighing on an economy that, you know, the labor market has been improving, the housing market has been improving, the infamous headwinds are no longer as bad as they were. And so, you know, again, an economy that's trying to go from a 2% to a 3%, and then you have this.
Well, and part of the weirdness, though, is, are those companies hiring? Are they making investments? We don't know, right? Because of the federal shutdown, the parts of the government that measure that stuff aren't, like, we're supposed to get that big jobs report on Friday. No, right?
Right. So here we're talking about this, that if we were having this conversation, what, just 2 weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago, we'd be talking about the Fed and tapering. And this is all about the Federal Reserve has done this quantitative easing. And there's this enormous concern about, as the Fed sort of, you know, starts reducing that quantitative easing, it's called the tapering. And the whole discussion was about the job market. And on Friday, we're not going to get the job figures. And we don't get – there's a lot of Department of Agriculture figures that aren't coming out. And so people are trying to tap into some private databases and trying to figure out what's going on. But the longer this goes on, the more we're business, the Federal Reserve, and the global economy is starting to fly a little bit blind.
We'll talk more about the impact of what happens if we do – hit that debt ceiling crunch, if we don't raise the limit, and what happens to us and maybe mortgages and other loans we take. We're talking to Chris Farrell, economics editor for Marketplace Money.
Coming up at the end of the hour, we'd like to hear from you on the politics of the debt ceiling. Do you think the United States should raise a debt ceiling? Why or why not? And what do you think about the politics involved in all of this? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or go ahead and post on the Central Time Facebook page.
More talk about the debt ceiling and what it means coming up. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Chris Farrell, economics editor for Marketplace Money, about the debt ceiling crisis, the impending date, October 17th, when we no longer can borrow to pay our bills.
Coming up in a few minutes, we're asking you to weigh in on the politics of the debt ceiling. Do you think the United States should go ahead and raise the debt ceiling? Why or why not? And are you worried about how the U.S. might be perceived internationally? And who would you blame? Who do you blame about the debt ceiling crisis? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
All right, Chris. In that speech earlier, President Obama said one of the consequences of a failure to reach a deal on the debt ceiling will affect consumers. It'll make it harder to get mortgage loans, or higher rates on loans like that could be the outcome. Why would that be?
Well, because if you think of the classic 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, right, that's sort of the mainstay of the American home-buying market. And everything, you know, that's whenever we're talking about mortgages. I know there are adjustable-rate mortgages and other things, but that's really what we're talking about. That's priced off of 10-year treasuries. So it's, you know, within the jargon term, there's a spread over 10-year treasuries, a percentage and a half, 2 percentage points over treasury. But you use that treasury, that riskless security, to price what is, you know, not a riskless security, but, you know, a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Yeah, I know we've gone through a hard time in the housing market, but still, you know, most people still try and meet that mortgage payment. So you default on the debt. All of a sudden, people realize, hey, you know, This security is not as riskless as I thought. You have some selling. Interest rates go up. Your mortgage rate, by definition, is going to go up. And the same thing for corporations, because, again, most corporate debt, quality corporate debt, is priced off of treasuries. And so if interest rates in the treasury market abruptly go up, so is going to happen in the corporate market. So you can easily come up with a scenario where it starts spilling over throughout the economy. And then the big question will be, and we'll be on the phone, I guarantee you, the big question is going to be, well, then where do I put my safe money? My safe money was in Treasury bills. My safe money was in U.S. Treasuries. That's now no longer safe. Where do I put it? And so it's going to start that whole conversation, which will add to the spillover effect as it works its way through the markets.
So that's how it affects us on a day-to-day basis. President Obama also mentioned CEOs, corporate leaders, really worried about what's going to happen come October 17th.
Right.
What do they have in mind here?
Well, what they have in mind here is, you know, part of it is what's going on. What is going on? And I think that a number of CEOs, I mean, I think they've kind of put a hold on some projects just as they kind of get through this period of time. But the big fear, and what no one really knows, is, you know, do you remember back 5 years, in fact, we just went over the anniversary, in September 15th was the anniversary of the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. Mm-hmm. And the global economy froze up. And that's what really makes people afraid. They don't know if that's going to happen. But that's the fear, that this is a much bigger deal than Lehman Brothers going bankrupt. The U.S. Treasury, the full faith and credit of the federal government, the riskless security in the global economy. And one way of thinking about it is the United States was the epicenter of the global financial crisis back in 2008, and yet savings from around the world poured into U.S. Treasuries for safety. So now you remove that. What is the implication? No one wants to find out. You can spin a story of catastrophe. You can spin a story that, no, it's not quite a short-run catastrophe. Maybe it's a longer-term erosion, a lack of faith. But no one really wants to find out. And what the people on Wall Street and what big business basically believes is because it's you don't want to find out, it's not going to happen. It doesn't make sense. It's irrational. And that's part of the problem that we're having right now.
Talking to Chris Farrell with Marketplace Money about the debt ceiling debate. And we want to hear from you. In a few minutes, we're going to let you sound off on this issue. Who do you blame, if anyone? Are you frustrated with both parties? Are you worried? Are you freaked out about the consequences of what's going to happen in a week or so? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@WPR.org. Chris, President Obama also mentioned that this could end up costing us money. It'll make it more expensive for the United States to borrow money, ultimately could raise the deficit, he was arguing.
Yeah, and here the argument is it's just by raising that we're just going to have to pay more, the government would have to pay more to borrow because, again, we're no longer the riskless security. And so that has implications of what the interest rate will be. It will go up a little bit. There's been some economic studies that looked at the near default in 2011. And, you know, there was a little bit of an implication that lingered in terms of some slightly higher interest rates at that particular point in time that you really didn't want. So, again, there's nothing good that can be said about this. There's nothing good to be said about it for as a country. There's nothing good to be said as an investor. There's nothing good that can be said as a consumer. But there's also a great deal of uncertainty because in the post-World War II era, the U.S. Securities, the Treasury, has kind of been the benchmark for safety for the global economy. And once that changes, we've entered into a new world, a different world, and you know, sometimes it's kind of fun to enter a different world. This isn't one that you want to enter into.
Well, and I want to take it there. You've mentioned, in effect, that the whole world is watching what happens here.
Absolutely.
In the long run, are policymakers in other countries, investors in other countries saying, it's been a good run with the United States. We need to start thinking of a different international economic mechanism?
That conversation has been going on for about it flares up and down, but I would say over the past 10 years, and there was a long conversation about that the euro would provide that alternative. Well,
whoops.
That was exactly right. Oops is right. And then there's some talk about the Chinese currency might be the currency of the future. They have so far to go that that's not going to happen. I mean, in the end, you know, the United States has global responsibilities. And we also get global benefits from being the economic superpower that we are. So why would you squander that? It makes no sense. And I think that's where business and finance, that community is sort of looking at what's going on and saying, look, there's a good fight about, you know, how you taxes and tax reform and immigration reform, but you're not dealing with any of this stuff. And why are you even talking about this? Because nobody benefits if there's a default. Shutdown and default are two different things. Mm-hmm. Default is really bad.
Chris, as always, thanks a lot for helping us out.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
That was Chris Farrell, economics editor for Marketplace Money. Well, now it's your turn. We're going to go to the phones, and you can sound off on what you think about the politics of this debt ceiling debate, the blame game that's going on, and you can play that game, too, if you want. You can join in 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you catch a busy signal, you can keep dialing or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to Rick now in Grafton. Rick, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, yeah, so maybe I'm a little too simple-minded, but you know, for my household, I can't raise the debt ceiling if my kids want to go to college, if I want to do house repairs, etc. I've got this budget, and I have to live by that. Personally, I don't think we should raise it, the debt limit, and we need to get our house in order and come what may. That's my opinion.
All right. Thanks a lot for starting us off, Rick. Appreciate it. Now we have Roger with us in Green Bay. Roger, hi. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. And Rick and Grafton just stole my thunder.
Uh-oh.
I am not the least bit worried about the so-called default. I believe that absolutely 1,000% we need to stop spending more than we're bringing in tax dollars. We need to stop borrowing. And in conclusion, I will say this, and we can compare it to a household. You can compare it to a multinational corporation. If either one were being operated with these same sorts of false justifications for more and more borrowing, the management would be ridiculed. We need to stop now. So, no, I'm not worried about the default. And as far as blaming anybody, there's nobody to blame. So anyway, that's my thought.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Roger. We'll go now to JB in Wisconsin Dells. JB, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thank you. I just wanted to kind of reiterate the last person's comment there towards the end in that be it the corporations in the economy or the government itself, it's just composed of people. We are the people, so it's kind of up to every individual to make the change from within. And also pointing blame left or right, whatever party, as far as I'm concerned, that's no different than saying black, white, and yellow. It's just a divide and conquer, take the attention away from the real issue, which is at hand. So that's my comments. Thank you.
JB, thanks a lot for calling. Well, our guest was worried about the debt ceiling. Our caller's not quite as worried for the most part. Let's see what Todd in Green Bay thinks. Todd, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. One of the things that I think the Obama White House has always lived by, as long as Rahm Emanuel was there, was that never let a crisis go to waste. And they have used this concurrent resolution and their refusal, really, to pass a budget for the last 5 years. It's been since 2009. All of this could have been avoided if Obama would have put forth a reasonable budget and if the Senate would have even allowed it to come up for a vote. But we wind up in the same situation every year because they want this issue to explode, and then they want to blame Republicans and hope that everybody forgets about what they've done in the past. And I think that we're going to wind up in a situation where we're going to have to look at spending at some point in time because we have so much duplication in government right now that it's ridiculous the amount of money we spend.
Gotcha.
And Obama just throwing $1 trillion more at the debt ceiling is not going to help.
Thanks for the call, Todd. We've got John with us now in Wauwatosa. Hi there, John.
Hi. My comment is that if we try and take a household budget or even a multinational corporate budget and think that that's representative, running that kind of a budget is representative of running a global economy, that doesn't make any sense. I think it's what we run into when we take these narrow and smaller, I should say, when I say narrow, I don't mean it in a derogatory way, but I do mean that there's not an understanding of the implications of decisions that are made by the United States and how they spread across the world.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. That's thank you so much, all of you, for your calls. Thanks to Chris Farrell for joining us for some debt ceiling talk.
And we'll talk more about the politics of the debt ceiling tomorrow with a guest from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. That's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Next is the news, then a guest who says the next food revolution will be getting rid of food waste. This is Central Time on the Ideas Net.